This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Funerals may not go back to what they were before the pandemic.
Those type of ideas and concepts will have a significant change in the future of what many people have always been accustomed to.
Funeral director Dan Brady says video services, quick burials, and delayed memorials are all here to stay. Plus, Unit 5 is getting ready for summer school as a time to help 800 kids who've fallen behind grade level catch up. Illinois State University research shows more broadly education resources are not divided evenly in the nation, and that can make racial inequities worse. And new Bloomington Fire Chief Eric West talks about job one, diverse hiring. That and a news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on WGLT.
Support for Sound Ideas comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology, the best hearing device center in the Pantograph Reader's Choice Awards for the sixth year in a row. Bloomington Normal Audiology thanks the listeners and their continued vote of confidence as the leaders in hearing and technology. With a practice featuring five doctors, including two who wear hearing devices themselves, BNA takes a genuine interest in each patient and helps you keep hearing the most important sounds of your life. More information at bnaudiology.com. Bloomington Normal Audiology, here for you.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Let's run down some of the day's top stories. The head of the Bloomington Normal NAACP is calling for a peaceful response to the Derek Chauvin verdict, regardless of the outcome. NAACP President Linda Foster says those seeking racial justice have to stay focused on the mission.
We have been marching and protesting in the courts for many years, and we have never condoned looting because we got to stay focused. We need to condemn actions. So breaking a glass is not the answer. Breaking the ceiling glass is the answer.
Several dozen people were arrested after several nights of looting in Bloomington Normal last summer. That followed a large racial justice rally in Bloomington. Closing arguments began today in Chauvin's trial. He faces murder and manslaughter charges in the death of George Floyd last May. The Unit 5 district expects higher enrollment next year. Superintendent Kristen Weichel says a number of families left for private schools last year to make sure their kids had in-person classes 5 days a week during the pandemic. Weichel says there may also be a shift in at least one grade size because of the pandemic.
We'll probably have a larger kindergarten class enrolling, just because I think some parents who maybe had students kindergarten age eligible this year decided just to not enroll their students in school and, you know, wait till next school year.
Weichel says she expects most of the children who left for private schools to return to Unit 5. Weichel says hiring at Rivian could possibly also boost the number of children in the district. Registration has begun for fall classes. Fruit farmers in central Illinois are worried a freeze tomorrow night could destroy their crops. Tara Brockman says apples, peaches, and pears at her family farm in Eureka started to blossom earlier this year because of warmer weather in March.
There's a good chance, depending on how cold it gets and how long the cold lasts overnight, how many nights, we may not have any tree fruit. I mean, that is a sad thing.
Brockman says some of the other fruits grown at the farm, strawberries, blueberries, and raspberries, can be covered. Brockman says most of their vegetables are still stored in their hoop house, so they don't expect any vegetable loss. McLean County's active COVID-19 caseload and hospitalizations stabilized over the weekend. There are 53 county residents hospitalized with COVID, down one since Friday. Hospital capacity reached double digits for the first time in April, with 11% of Bloomington Normal hospital beds open. Health officials added 212 new COVID-19 cases over the weekend. That's the highest weekend case count reported since mid-January. The county's testing positivity rate held steady at 5.3%. Just over 106,000 doses of the COVID vaccine have been administered in McLean County. More than 45,000 residents are now fully vaccinated. That's more than 26% of the population, on par with the statewide average. The University of Illinois Extension says invasive jumping worms have been found in central Illinois. That may be bad news for gardeners. The worms rapidly consume the nutrients in the soil, leaving a coffee ground-like substance in its wake. University of Illinois Extension horticulture educator Nicole Flowers-Kimmerly says the name jumping worm is a bit of a misnomer, though.
They do move really fast, kind of snake-like, if you kind of startle them, but they don't jump out. And it sounds like what the Asian carp do when they jump, but that not jumping off the ground. Just when you hold them, they thrash.
While there's no way to purge the worm species once it has come, Flower Kimmerly says gardeners can help by bagging any adult jumping worms they find in plastic bags and leaving them in the sun. The worm's presence is confirmed in Woodford and McLean counties, and it's likely also in other areas as well. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology. BNA's educational video series, Hear My Story, continues with local patient Gina Barnhart.
But the ones I have now feel like they're like bionic ears, because like if I'm in a restaurant and there's background noise, I can adjust those so that they just go a certain way.
Gina's full story can be found at bnaudiology.com.
You're listening to Bloomington Normal's Public Media. Unit 5 schools are preparing to wind down a tumultuous year and wind up for a bigger-than-usual summer school. Unit 5 Superintendent Kristen Weichel says they will try to use those classes to help children with learning losses or deficits catch up.
The Illinois State Board of Education has really stressed to schools that students who, you know, have had a learning loss or that have the biggest academic or social-emotional gaps are those who districts should look at helping the summer. So that's exactly what we're doing here in Unit 5. So that might range from an English language learner who is still early in their development of learning the English language and being able to apply that. It might be a student who is in a Tier 3 of what we call our CARES program for academic or social-emotional support. Could be students who are two or more years delayed or behind in academic subjects. It might be students with IEPs who don't qualify for a traditional extended school year under the special education umbrella, but they need more support. Students who, you know, we've identified in the schools as having more extreme mental health or social-emotional needs. And then, of course, you know, students who might be experiencing some severe environmental factors such as homelessness, abuse, neglect, or, you know, some other extreme situation, or where maybe our supports and interventions just haven't helped the student make as much progress as what we would like to see.
How many students do you think are behind and will be admitted to this?
So it looks a little different at each level. So between our high schools, we expect to serve about 300 students. And so really when you think about, you know, the number of students we have in both high schools, that is a small percentage. At the junior high level, we're looking at approximately 100 students. And then at the pre-K through 5 level, we're looking at about 370 students.
And what's it going to cost to put on programming for those kids?
We budgeted $500,000 for this summer. I don't think that we're going to need all of that, because at one point we thought that we might need 3 sites for our K-5 students, and in reality we're only going to need 2 sites. So we're still in the process of hiring staff for all of those positions. At the K-5 level, parents have started to get letters inviting their students to participate. We're in the process of inviting our junior high and high school students in the next week or two. So, you know, part of it will be depending on how many families respond and choose to take advantage of the opportunity and send their student this summer.
District 87 is doing it for all students if they want it. What's the barrier to you doing that?
Every district looks different as far as availability of staff. District 87 is smaller than Unit 5, so for us to open it up to 13,000 plus students would be quite different. It would almost be where we'd have to retain all of our staff that we hire in the typical school year throughout the summer, and that's not really realistic.
Not everybody would take you up on it if you did.
Absolutely. Not every parent would, but not every staff member. You know, I think just like a lot of medical, you know, staff in our hospitals and medical fields, people are tired. And, you know, our teachers, our support staff, everyone's worked really hard for over a year in such an unusual circumstance. The other piece I'm going to say is not every district is in the same place with their curriculum and instruction. So when you look at, like, the sorts of curriculum supports that you have in place, whether it be your core content or your interventions, every district's in a different place, which means their students are at a different place with mastery of concepts and meeting standards.
That's Unit 5 Superintendent Kristen Weichel.
This is Sound Ideas on WGLT. Thanks for joining us this evening. I'm Eric Stock with Melissa Liebert for the final push of our spring fund drive. We're asking more friends to come forward and pay for this public service because we still have $25,000 left to reach our goal. Your contribution at WGLT.org will help push this fund drive across the finish line.
If you're wondering, well, why would I do that? Why would I contribute? Here are a few reasons. WGLT is a nonprofit. We're a community-powered station. Listener funding powers a local newsroom right down the street on the campus of Illinois State University. Your friends and neighbors cover the news in our community, not a nameless, faceless wire service from another city or state.
Your support pays for award-winning journalism, Associated Press Awards, Edward R. Murrow Awards, and much, much more decorate our newsroom. That level of journalism is worthy of your financial support. Please give at WGLT.org so we can continue.
Every day, the WGLT Newsroom brings you the stories that help you understand the day's news. Maybe you turn to WGLT for vaccination information or the latest from your elected officials.
A local newsroom matters. Newsrooms are shrinking. We don't have TV stations covering Bloomington Normal as in the past. WGLT and Sound Ideas bring you in-depth stories about health, community events, and newsmakers you won't hear anywhere else. When you donate at WGLT.org, your contribution powers Sound Ideas to lead off podcasts and that all-important local newsroom of award-winning journalists.
If you value local stories you only hear and read from WGLT, you need to make sure it continues. Now is the time to step up with your individual financial support at WGLT.org and pay for the news and programming that powers your day.
On our website, you can make a one-time gift or set up a monthly donation. You can also become a day sponsor for $1 a day. No donation is too big or too small. Every dollar is powerful and makes a big difference. Give this fund drive a boost and help us meet our goal in the final hours with your donation at WGLT.org.
Students of color in urban settings receive fewer educational resources to help them learn. That's according to Illinois State University researchers. Student reporter Dinesha Mitchell has more on the effects of those conditions and how to counter the harm.
The pandemic has helped spotlight education inequities in this country, but research conducted by a group of ISU scholars on under-resourced and underserved schools show this is a long-awaited conversation. Education professor Shemaine Bertrand says schools with mostly students of color, particularly Black students in lower income areas, have less of most things. School supplies, modern textbooks, quality facilities, and so on, than their counterparts in less diverse and higher income areas. Bertrand says structural inequities create learning issues.
Do you learn if you don't have all of the resources? And we always hear the language of achievement gaps, or there is Black students or Latinx students don't perform as well as their white peers, but we never really take time out to tease things out, the resources that are given to certain students as opposed to others.
Bertrand says ignoring the lack of investment in schools serving students of color prolongs the detrimental effects it has on those students. She says students who feel undervalued because of crumbling infrastructure suffer an emotional toll.
They really do play a part in the experience that students have in their classroom and whether or not they feel like they can continue. If I'm not financially stable at home and I don't have certain resources at home, and then I come into a school and I don't have resources there, why do I need to be here?
Bertrand and ISU scholar Aaron Quast put together an equity and diversity cohort in Decatur Public Schools a few years ago. It places teaching candidates from the Chicago suburbs and rural areas in urban schools to show them how students are learning with limited resources. Quas says the teaching candidates are stunned by the conditions students face.
We have students that once they get over the initial, this is different, are very upset that this is the first time in their lives that they have to think about people outside of them.
Quas says the program helps dispel harmful stereotypes and biases about students and families with financial hardships. She says it helps teaching candidates understand no one style of teaching is helpful in inequitable systems.
Listening to the people that we serve as educators to find out, you know, really how we can make sure that families and individuals are successful and that we remove the barriers that are in front of them and give them the opportunities to succeed.
Quas says more programs like the Equity and Diversity Cohort would better prepare educators to understand inequities in education, improve teaching strategies, and advocate for underserved students. I'm Darnisha Mitchell.
This is the WGLT Spring Fund Drive. Please make your contribution to All Things Considered, to Morning Edition, to Sound Ideas, and all the other shows that you listen to on 89.1 FM. You can do that at WGLT.org. New Bloomington Fire Chief Eric West came into his new role this week with a clear directive from the city manager: recruit more firefighters, especially minorities. West tells Eric Stock, diverse hiring has been a challenge at the department where he's worked nearly three decades.
We've not been successful, I'll put it that way. I mean, we've had candidates on the list. We've hired some candidates, and we've had some candidates that have left us and just due for to other reasons. And then we've had some candidates that didn't quite meet the standards that we had. So, you know, and then the part of it is we're just not getting those individuals into the to applicant process. And I think there's, you know, a couple reasons for that. And, you know, we need to look and see how we can improve and help get those applicants get those individuals into the applicant process.
Why are they not applying?
Well, I think part of it, I think City Manager Gleason mentioned it in your interview with him, is, you know, the paramedic requirement. And, you know, the paramedic requirement basically is an associate's degree from, let's say, like Heartland Community College. And so, you know, financially, some people may not be able to afford that. I don't know. You know, and I think we just need to get out there better and sell what our services are, what we do, and that, you know, we are looking for those diverse candidates to come in and help it. This is a good job. I mean, you know, it pays well, and I think we just need to kind of stress that.
How common is the paramedic requirement for firefighters?
So we started this back when the department ended up going paramedic, and that was the best way we thought of doing this. We needed to get several paramedics on staff. And then we just felt from that point on, once we started the paramedic service, that we just needed to continue that requirement. So one, you know, you get them here and we got to send them to paramedic school. It's about an associate's degree. So you're looking at 2 years of training before they truly become a paramedic. And so you look at that a couple of different ways. You're paying some overtime for them to go to classes, or you're paying backfill overtime when maybe they're doing ride time or something like that. And then just getting them here and getting them so we can put them right to work.
Is it financially feasible for the department to carry the cost of the training for all of the new hires?
That's something we're going to take a look at. I think it is. It's just, we need to make sure budget-wise that, we can afford it.
What kind of outreach has the fire department done or the city done to try to attract a minority candidates for firefighting positions?
So I know I've not been involved in a whole lot of that. And I know our public education officer, Eric Davison, has been working with our HR department on trying to get out to community colleges. I know we've been up north in the suburbs, and I'm not even sure they haven't been in the city a little bit. Trying to reach out up in there. I'm sure they're reaching out on all the websites that they can. I know we just got a couple more provided to us that I'm going to make sure we get out on. But to tell you for sure exactly where we're at, I can't. Like I said, I've not been involved in that process, and I'm just, you know, being kind of getting brought up to speed on this whole thing with I'm not sure all the places.
City Manager Tim Gleason had said it's important that firefighters look like the community that they serve, and you hear that often when it comes to police. Why is it important when you're fighting a fire or responding to a medical call?
Well, I mean, just the police, we're out there every day, you know, and responding to anybody. We have the areas town where we have the minorities, and, you know, there's probably some minorities that are uncomfortable when we pull up and they see, you know, an all white crew get off. I don't think we have nearly the amount of problems that, you know, unfortunately the police do with that. But, you know, I think it, there's some comfort there. You know, if you see individuals, of your own that are pulling up to help you, you know, I think our guys do a great job with everybody. You know, we've not had really any complaints or anything. So I can understand, and, you know, we would like to get there, and we're working on it.
That's Bloomington Fire Chief Eric West with Eric Stock. West says the department is down 8 full-time firefighters, but hopes to fill those positions soon if it gets enough qualified applicants. The starting salary will be $61,000. The Normal Fire Department has 2 minority firefighters on its staff. Both are Latino. This is the WGLT Spring Fund Drive, and you can make a contribution at WGLT.org to get close to the goal of $75,000 to support the programming that you listen to day in, day out. The federal government rolled out a program to help families of COVID victims cover funeral expenses, but there's some confusion at the outset. The Federal Emergency Management Agency launched a call center last week and was overwhelmed by more than 1 million calls. The most common question, are we eligible? State Representative Dan Brady, a funeral director by trade, tells WGLT's Dana Vollmer the answer could be tricky. Brady says the biggest gray area is cause of death.
A number of deaths related to those that are more elderly, they have had a contributory cause of death listed as COVID, but the more immediate cause of death has been underlying symptoms and conditions they've had for years, heart disease, renal failure, dementia, those that have been mentioned as immediate cause on the death certificate. If a contributory cause, which is meant to be secondary, will that qualify for funeral assistance? My recommendation would be is that the family, if they have these questions, reach out to their United States congressman, reach out to FEMA itself, and or their funeral provider to see if they can assist them in trying to obtain the answers to some of these questions.
This program covers up to $9,000 in funeral costs, which sounds like a lot of money, but how far does that actually get families?
That varies from what services are selected by a family. One of the things that families would have to do, obviously, is they would have to have information from their funeral home provider, and that information meaning some type of copies of what the statement was for funeral goods and services, expense documents, proof of funds from other sources. If there are some other sources that help, for instance, if it was a Medicaid service, the state of Illinois may have been responsible for paying something. If it was a funeral insurance burial policy, if it was some form of other life insurance and things, those were, from what I can understand, would be utilized to pay the services. Therefore, that would not make them eligible for this type of assistance.
Funeral homes are an essential service, but they're also a business, right? How has the pandemic hurt practices like yours economically, and how helpful is this FEMA money?
From a business standpoint for the industry, you may look at families that have set aside in a trust or insurance burial policy or something, and maybe not utilized all the ideas that they had for a church funeral service or a traditional funeral visitation or something like that. And then making those cost adjustments with the family and coming to a understanding of a price side of things when maybe the full traditional service is not going to be carried out in the manner in which someone had drafted a prearrangement 10, 15, however many years ago. So that's a consideration from a business model that many firms are dealing with, to provide the service and yet to be as responsible financially to what their loved one wanted.
Are funerals starting to look a little more traditional now that COVID vaccination rates are increasing?
It has changed for the better from the standpoint of families having some more flexibility. if the family does have a church family, a church home, churches are allowed more flexibility in numbers for attending a funeral service, a visitation, but the numbers even to the firms have increased, to funeral firms, you know, more being able to have around 50 people or so in a service. That has increased now. We still see a number of people, though, that have decided that even if cremation is not their final means of disposition for a loved one, that more of a maybe immediate burial is still being widely utilized.
Could some of these changes be permanent?
I think so. I think the industry, the funeral industry, has once again adapted to a change, whether it's live streaming, whether it's video of some other kind, whether it's immediate burial and something at the grave versus what was more traditional.
That's State Representative and Funeral Director Dan Brady talking to Dana Vollmer. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Charlie Schlenker, and you can make a contribution to support Sound Ideas and All Things Considered and everything else you listen to on 89.1 FM at WGLT.org. Please give, and thanks.